All right, we'll make a start. In the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, one God, amen. There's a couple of new faces, so welcome to tonight. This is actually the third session of this series, which is titled Introduction to Apologetics. So we had a look at the very first talk. We had a look at sort of an introduction to the introduction. We talked about what apologetics is, why we need apologetics, how we go about it, and so forth. We discussed things such as morality, meaning, destiny, origin, and things like that. And we looked at the secular worldview and we looked at the Christian worldview. Last week, we had a look at the heavens. So we looked outside of the Bible and we looked at the universe and the world in which we lived for evidence for the existence of God. And so we looked at two arguments. Does anybody remember what the arguments were, by the way? The two arguments that we discussed last week? Anybody?
It was Einstein, which was the false one.
Yeah, so Einstein's theory of relativity, we actually had a look, yeah, we got very scientific. So we had a look at two arguments. Yeah, Miriam was referring to Einstein's previous work, which led to the whole Big Bang and the universe expanding and things like that, which told us that the universe had a beginning. This is called the cosmological argument, fancy name. And the other argument is called the design argument, which is basically to look at the universe in which we live, to look at the earth in which we live, and to see just how perfectly tuned it is, how finely tuned it is for human life, which again points to a creator, points to someone who's designed the universe and the earth just the way it is for life to flourish. So they're the two arguments. So that's looking outside and into the universe. But I was hoping tonight we'd look inside and within ourselves. Okay, so we titled tonight The Search for God Within, and I wanted to talk about how we can find evidence for God by looking within ourselves. As Christians, we firmly believe that we were created in the image and likeness of God. We talked a little bit about what that means sort of in a previous series a couple of months ago, what image and likeness actually means. So we're created in God's image and we are to work towards the likeness of God. But the very fact that we were created in the image and likeness of God means that there's something inside of us that's intrinsically good. So something within us is good just because of our Creator being good, right? So this is what we're talking about tonight, and in a nutshell, it's called the moral argument. So it's an argument for looking within our conscience, within our moral decisions, to see that there is a greater good and there's a greater God who's inscribed these morals within us. Okay, what do I mean by morality? Do you know what I mean by morality? It's basically, like I said, it's the conscience and the thing inside us that tells us what's right and what's wrong and what actions we need to take and things like that. Being able to discern between right and wrong. But I thought we'd actually revisit what we spoke about in the very first series, which is what the secular view of morality is. Okay, so you'll remember that according to the secular view, moral beliefs were ingrained in us through a long, drawn-out process of evolution. This is not the Christian view. This is the atheist view. Through evolution, the process of evolution, through social conditioning, so how society has developed over the generations and the centuries, and also through our chemical composition. So when I make a decision, I'm making the decision based on years of evolution, based on my genetics and my chemical makeup, and also based on what society has trained me to do. That's the atheist or the secular worldview. And we talked about this in the very first week, that brings a bit of an issue for us as humans, because if that were the case, if every decision I make, every choice between right and wrong I make is based on my evolution, my genetics, my chemical composition, and so forth, does that mean that I've got free will? Does that mean that I have free will? What do you guys think? if these are the things determining my actions and determining what I think is right and what I think is wrong, does that mean that I have free will?
Could it also mean that you've got free will limited within those parameters?
Sorry, can I get you to use the microphone? Otherwise, I'll be in very big trouble.
Well, does it mean that you've got free will limited within those parameters that you mentioned, culture, evolution, and so forth?
What do you guys think? That's a good question. Does it mean that? That's a very good question. What do you guys think? Please, tonight, I want this to be a discussion, because otherwise it's going to get very boring just listening to me talk. If my evolution, my genetic makeup, my chemical compositions going on within the brain are determining every choice that I make, does that mean that I have free will? All right. Let me tell you what the popular atheists of today say. So Richard Dawkins, who I've mentioned in the last couple of weeks, he's a very prominent atheist and he writes extensively. He wrote The God Delusion. I don't know if anyone's heard of that book. Sold thousands and thousands of copies, talking about the fact that God, in his eyes, the fact that God doesn't exist. He concedes that if you look at humanity in that way, it's actually... It's ridiculous, or it doesn't make sense to think that we've got free will. And he says, it's actually interesting, he says that, but then he talks about free will, and he uses free will in his discussions and so forth. And when he was pulled up on why the fact on the fact that he uses free will in his discussions, he says, because life will be intolerable if we were to think that we don't have free will. And in his own words, he says that this is an inconsistency that we have to live with. Another prominent atheist, his name is Sam Harris, wrote a whole book on free will. And the premise of the book, the idea of the whole book, is that free will is actually an illusion. So he says, you know, we live in this world day to day, thinking we've got free will. The fact of the matter is we don't have free will. We're just like our friends in the animal kingdom, basically. So that means that we are actually not indifferent. We're not any different from the animals. I got this quote up here. Sorry, it's a bit of a long quote, but I got this quote up here from argumentsforatheism.com. Okay? So you can check that website up yourself. But this is what the quote says. It says, "Our moral sentiments appear to have evolved out of the pre-moral sentiments observed in other higher mammals, particularly in the more intelligent mammals such as elephants, dolphins, and whales, and to an even greater extent in the animals genetically closest to humans, the great apes and monkeys. The fact that the foundations of morality, guilt, and conscience are most apparent in these animals evolutionarily closest to us strongly suggests that morality has evolutionary origins." What do you guys think of that quote? Is that an accurate description? Is there anything about that quote that bothers anybody here?
I would say I don't like being likened to animals.
That's a good point, yeah. So.
I don't think that the monkeys and the apes will have conscience and guilt.
Perfect, beautiful, exactly. Did everyone hear that? Amma was saying that The biggest issue with that, there's actually quite a few things that bothers me about this quote. The biggest issue is that they actually talk about monkeys and animals and other forms of wildlife as having morality, having guilt and conscience, and that it's apparent in these animals. I tend to think, there's no actual proof that there is guilt and conscience present within animals, within the animal kingdom. In fact, look at the animal kingdom. When a lion goes and kills a zebra, does it make the 6 p.m. news? Do they say there was murder committed by a lion against the zebra? No, right? Is it considered murder? It's not considered murder. Another example is the great white shark. The great white shark, when it comes to mating season, the male goes and finds himself a nice female shark and impregnates her. Without her consent, right? So forcibly. Does that make the news as rape? Is that considered rape? No. So these things occur on a daily basis in the animal kingdom, and we do not look at them as being moral, bad moral choices or things like that. This is instinctual for these animals, and they're acting out of their own instinct. There is no moral dimension for the animal kingdom. So that's the biggest issue with that quote right there. Thank you, Amma. But that's the view that the atheist has. If God doesn't exist, then ultimately you and I are no different from the animals. We're just maybe higher beings, more intelligent beings, but at the end of the day, we are not under any obligation to make any right decision, to make any wrong decision. In fact, right and wrong are arbitrary. Right for you, maybe wrong for me, and vice versa. Okay? And this is where the idea of moral relativism comes from. Okay? So the secular world these days is telling us that there's no objective morality, there's no overall arching morality. No. Morality, my choices of right and wrong depend on me and my upbringing and so forth, and that can be different from person to person. But we as Christians believe that God has ingrained us with a moral law, ingrained on our hearts, the very moral law. This law is not subjective, so it's not based on personal opinions and so forth, and it's not based on the environment or upbringing or society or anything else like that. It's objective. That's what I mean by objective morality. And this is what the Bible has to tell us. This is a great summary of Christian morality. We're told in Romans chapter 2, verse 14 and 15, "For when the Gentiles, who do not have the law, by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them." So what's that talking about? St. Paul here is telling us about the Gentiles who don't know the God of the Jews and who aren't introduced to Christ. They're not aware of the law of Moses. They're not aware of the commandments of Christ. But they have something within them. That thing that's within them is this moral law that we're talking about. And they will do what's right and wrong based on that law, and they will be accountable based on that law that's within them. Now, this law doesn't need to be taught to us, doesn't need to be introduced to us in any way. You don't need to discover it. It's something that we grow up with. We're just born intrinsically to have this law within us. So this is, in a nutshell, the moral argument. Okay. What I wanted to do is actually spend the rest of the night putting up. I basically searched the net for some of the biggest objections from atheists regarding this very idea, and I thought, let's just put a few of them up there. And let's have a chat about it. See what you guys think. See what you guys would say to some of these objections. Some of them are sort of straightforward objections. You'd say, no, that's not right because of this and this and this. Some of them are a little bit more hard to sort of deal with. But it's a good time to dialogue about this very argument of morality. Okay? But I need you to get involved with me. Otherwise, you're going to get very bored from hearing my voice. Okay? Objection one. Wait, sorry, before we continue, are there any questions? Anything that you want me to clarify before we continue? All good? Yeah? Okay. Objection one. And these are, again, objections by... I sort of tried to look around. These are objections, the most common objections by atheists, those of the secular world. Objection number one. When we talk about the moral argument, are you saying that all atheists are bad people? With this argument, are we saying that atheists are bad people? And then I got this again, this quote, I got this from argumentsforatheism.com, and this is what they have to say. "In reality, it is neither necessary to follow a religion in order to be moral, nor is a religion sorry, nor is a religious person necessarily a moral one. Morality, ethics, and values can happily exist in a godless, secular context, as demonstrated by the many godless atheists who lead moral lives every day. What do you guys, if someone came to you and said that very statement to you, what would you say in return? Who dictates morality? Good question. I repeated the question, but next time, use the mic. Who dictates morality? That's a good question. Who dictates morality? The one thing I was... Sorry.
I'm just saying as an answer to that one, that would take them to the original argument that we just explained earlier. It's evolution, culture, genetics. Would that be...
Genetics don't dictate morality. Morality is something that is learned and has to be made from someone, so go all the way here. Morality is nothing that's dictated. It's a learned behavior. So where are we learning it? Who are we emulating? Who was the initial person to begin this idea of morality?
Excellent. Yes. Good point. Good point. The one thing I would say before we start any sort of dialogue is, let's remember that anybody who makes these statements is also a son and daughter, or is also a created being, someone who is our brother or sister. We love them, and we want to bring them towards the knowledge of Christ. So we have to do so with love. We have to do so with respect and with sort of honor. Okay. When I think about apologetics, I think that it's actually a form of evangelism. You're not just defending the faith in the sense that, you know, you're putting up a guard and you're saying, no, this is the truth, and if you don't like it, then you know where to go. It's actually a fact of a form of evangelism. So I'm treating that person with love. I'm trying to share the good news with that person so that they can see Christ and they can meet Christ through us, right? But the points that you brought up were fantastic. Thank you. What about the actual statement? Does anyone have anything to say before we continue? Any other comments? Do you agree or disagree with this comment? Are you saying that all atheists are bad people?
No.
In fact, I know some people who don't believe in God who I'm embarrassed to be around because they're much better than I am as a person. So we don't have any objections. We're not saying that atheists are bad people at all. In fact, I'll give you a story to demonstrate that it's the opposite. It's the very fact that the atheist, or some of the atheists, are very good people that demonstrates the existence of God. What do I mean by that? This is a story that happened to me at work. We were sitting around the table during, I think it was lunch, and we were just having a chat, and someone happened to mention God. I don't know if they were saying it sort of in a joking manner or something, or whatever it was. But anyway, God was mentioned just as another colleague of mine was coming to sit down. And the colleague's reaction was, he started laughing and he said, God? He said, God's not real. And he sat down and we just continued. Anyway, I don't work directly with this person, so he didn't know that I'm a Christian. But a lot of the other people around that table knew that I'm a Christian. So they all turned and looked at me as if, you know, let's see how this is going to pan out. And of course, I'm not the type of person who's going to, you know, start arguments or anything like that. My response was basically along the lines of, you know, believe me, God is more real to me than you are. And I just said it like that. I said it with a smile on my face. People sort of moved on. Nothing eventuated. And that was the end of it. Thank God. But what happened a couple of months ago was this same man, he's a middle-aged man, he was talking to me. And I was just getting to know him. And I asked him what he does in his spare time. And he basically told me this. He said he drives around to particular bakeries during the week. He picks up bags and bags of bread, and he drops it off at the Salvos. And I asked him why. And he basically said, oh, my daughter volunteers at the Salvos. And so I drop off the bread to the Salvos, and then she goes on a particular night, and they basically hand out food and the bread and so forth. And I said to him, wow, that's really nice. That's a very sort of noble cause. Well done, good on you. And this was his response, right? He basically shrugged his shoulders and said, look, he goes, I don't know. It just seems like the right thing to do. And he walked off. That response right there to me is this moral argument. This man and his daughter, both of them are atheists, quite open about it, right? Don't believe in God, and yet he feels compelled to go and pick up bread, drive around town, pick up bread, deliver it to the salvos. He encourages his daughter to go and volunteer, and they do things like that. Why? Why would they do something like that even though they don't believe in God? And that's what we're referring to right there. That is that moral argument. That is the fact that something good is ingrained in each and every one of us, whether you're a Christian, a Muslim, an atheist, or somebody with a weird and wonderful faith, God has ingrained in us something good.
They can, just to play the devil's advocate, they can still argue that culture is what... They can still argue that it's the culture that's taught them that.
Yes. Yes, and they do, absolutely. They can and they do. But from our perspective, there is absolutely no need to do so. From an evolutionary perspective, where evolution is about the strongest and the fittest and survival and so forth, is there a need to help the poor or not? What do you think? From a community perspective, I would say there is. I would say from a community, if I help you and I take care of you and I scratch your back, I do so. Sorry, I'm talking as a person who doesn't believe in God. I do so in good faith, for lack of a better word, that you'll do the same for me and you'll help me if I'm ever in trouble. So it's more about my survival, but not in a direct way. This is when we're talking about communities and so forth. But for someone to go and help the poor, the weakest of the weak, basically, is there an incentive to do so? Yeah, absolutely, yeah. There's not really anything for them to gain. And so you have to ask why. You have to ask the question why, right?
Can I play devil's advocate for a second? Because I think what we're discussing actually supports that statement, that you can have morality without having a religious basis.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. Because what happens is if you ever mention this moral argument, the very first question or the very first objection you're going to get is, wait a sec, are you saying I'm a bad person? This is the atheist talking. But what we're not saying that at all. In fact, we're saying the opposite. We're saying the fact that you're good demonstrates that there's a higher morality ingrained within you, and we attribute that to God. That's the argument in a nutshell. Yeah, we're not arguing against this objective at all. Yeah? Happy to move on? Okay. Objection number two. It seems that morality is not absolute as you say it is. It seems that morality is not as absolute as you say it is. What do you guys think?
We need to clarify questions.
I think that's a good idea. Sorry? Okay. When we say absolute, when I talk about absolute morality, it's saying that this action is good. There's absolutely no other description for it rather than that it's good. This action is bad, and there's no other way to describe it than to say this is bad. When we talk about objective morality, we're not saying this action is good and this action is bad. We're actually saying that don't focus on the action. Focus on the morality inside you that's outside of you. You know, you have an urge that this is right, you have an urge that this is wrong, not so much because of the action itself, but because something inside you compels you to act that way. Does that make sense, or did I just confuse everybody? I know the words are very confusing, so I do apologize. Absolute and objective. There's a little bit of a difference. For example, I'll give you an example. Killing someone. You know, when you first think about it, killing someone, of course it's wrong. But what if killing someone, what if we're killing someone to stop an evil? So for example, if there is a dictator who's putting his own people under tortures or whatever it may be. He's causing evil in the world. Are we obliged to act or not? Now, when you think about killing, you think, okay, wait a sec. It's not black and white, so it's not absolute. Does that make sense? We'll go into that a little bit later, I think. I hope. So, okay, I'll give you another example. So let's say that from tomorrow, our nation, or let's say the US, because we follow everything that the US does, the US declares that atheists, because Trump is a Christian, the US declares that all atheists are going to be tortured to death. Okay? Trump makes that... we're recording, yeah? Trump makes that statement. He says all atheists are bad, therefore we're going to torture them until they die. Is that a moral thing to do?
No.
Who said no?
No?
Why? Is that moral?
No.
So you just screamed out the word no. So something inside you...
Are you saying that torturing somebody for having a different belief until they die can be moral?
I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying this is an example. No, I'm actually saying what you're saying is good. You straight out, without a second to spare, you screamed out, no, it's incorrect.
I also think assassinating somebody is also absolutely wrong.
You also think assassinating is also absolutely wrong. Good, okay. But we're using the word absolutely, and we're trying to think above absolutely, right? Good. No, that's good. That's a very good example. So it doesn't matter. So that's the scenario. It doesn't matter if the whole world decides that this is a good thing to do. Deep down, we know that it's the wrong thing to do, okay? So we're not talking about absolute here. We're talking about objective, okay? This will make sense, hopefully, a little bit later. Hopefully. Sorry, was there anything else before we move on? I'm just a bit conscious of the time. Objection 3. Where's your evidence for objective morality? This is probably the most common question. What evidence do you have? Because we brought up the idea that society does have a role to play. We brought up the idea that, you know, our upbringing and so forth, all of these things are factors. So where is our evidence? Where is our evidence? Where would I go to find evidence?
You can always switch it the other way around. Where is the evidence of, you know, morality being non-existent, non-objective?
Can you say that again? Sorry.
So you can always, you know, switch it the other way around. So where is the evidence that morality is non-objective?
Good. Very good point. That's a very legitimate question. Very good. What else? What else would we say? Anybody? Would I find proof for morality in the lab, for example? In the lab? In a science lab? Could we do some sort of scientific experiment to find proof for this objective morality that we keep speaking about?
No.
No. Okay. So where would I find it? You see, science can describe for us how things work. We look at the phenomena, we look at the environment around us, and by observation and by testing, we can come to a conclusion. How do you do that with morality? How do you do that with morality?
Could you do a survey?
You could do a survey. You could do a survey. I'm just, to be honest, this is a learning experience for me. I would love to know what people would say. I've only been in here's the thing. I work at a research and development organization. A lot of my colleagues are either physicists or chemists and things like that. A lot of them are atheists. I get into very interesting conversations. Very uncomfortable conversations, and a lot of them are very heated, and I'm not very good at handling this sort of dialogue. But it's always good to hear what other people have to say. Okay?
I think it may be worthwhile just to redirect the question into, okay, where is the source of morality coming from, as opposed to giving evidence of morality?
Yes. Yeah. Brilliant. Say it again so the people...
I'm just thinking. Just to shift the thinking process of that person who's asking you the question, you know, from getting evidence for morality to directing their attention to what is the source of morality to start with, and having a different argument where we're supposed to focus rather than there.
I think that's a fantastic response. I really do. Great. Okay, so this is what I was going to say. That's just to add to what you said. I think that's fantastic. I was going to say that science, like we said, can explain many things, but it can't explain morality. And the reason is because morality is about being able to determine what's right and what's wrong. Okay? You can't test that in a test tube. You can't test that in a lab. But what we do need to find is the source of morality. And for us, that source is outside of, you know, the physical world. And for us, that source is God, namely God, right?
It's the same with truth and beauty and what, you know, you don't have to measure evidence for objective morality. No, I think I'm on the track.
No, I actually think you're right.
The same as where is the evidence for love, or where is the evidence for
truth,
or something intangible that science doesn't have any.
Yeah, science, that's what I'm trying to say. Science doesn't, you can't test everything in the lab.
Beautiful. These are called abstract things. How do you test for these things? You can't. Okay? That's absolutely right. But I would also question that, and I would say we can actually find evidence for morality, objective morality, if we're genuine and we really do want to seek it. And I think the solution to that, or the answer to where we find it, is to look within ourselves. Okay? We've got, all right, as a physical human being, I've got my senses. I've got 5 senses by which to test, you know, to see, to test, to touch, to smell, to hear. I forgot what the 5 are. Objects around me, and that's how I determine what these objects are, and that's my sort of perception of the world. I think we can do the same thing with morality. I think the same exists with our moral experience. So if you want to test, you know, this objective morality, I think we can find it inside. That would be my answer. And here's the thing. Some people, and this is a tough question to answer, some people would say, okay, you say there's objective morality, but there are some moral dilemmas out there. How is morality objective? How is it bigger than us? How is it found, ingrained in me, if I have these dilemmas that I struggle to make a decision with? I'll give you an example. I was just hearing this on my way out. The US, you know, the sanctions that the US have put on illegal immigrants entering the border. Is that moral? Do you think these sanctions are moral? Or do you think that they are immoral or evil? What do you guys think? That's a tough call to make, isn't it? What do you guys think? I think it's a tough call. In fact, I think it depends on which side of the border you're on, if you think about it, right? As a Mexican who's struggling to leave my country because of whatever's going on, or as a refugee in general, I'm trying to do the best for my family and so forth. I'm trying to do what's right for me. But as a citizen of a country that's established, you know, you're also trying to protect your border. So these are sticky sort of moral dilemmas that we do face as humans. But that doesn't mean that the objective morality doesn't exist. Right? That's what I was trying to get at with the senses. My senses are not 100%. I'm wearing glasses for that very reason, right? I struggle to see. But that doesn't mean that I give up on my eyesight and say, no, there's no world, there's no objects that are surrounding me, because I just don't trust my eyesight anymore. And that's the same with objective morality, our morality. This is another incident that I had at work. I've got a colleague who I've known for about 10 years now, and he, when I first met him about 10 years ago, he was a Catholic. And then about 8 years ago, he basically left the faith, and he classifies himself as an atheist now. Anyway, a couple of years ago, he came into my room, and we were just having a chat, and he told me about this documentary or book or something that he read that basically speaks about humanity, and he talks about the human being as basically a carrier of genes. So he's basically dumbed us down to the very fact that we're just carrying genes, and my whole purpose in life as a carrier of these genes is to pass them on through procreation so that my genes live on and then I die, but my genes will live on. And he says that's the whole idea of why people are always looking to settle down and get married and to have kids. That's the whole purpose of our humanity. And I thought, really? I mean, he was a Catholic. I said, really? Like, that's what you come to believe now? And he said, yeah. He says, it's very plausible. He says, I'm convinced it seems like it's a logical thing. Anyway, I generally struggle with these questions because I'm not very good at thinking on my feet. In fact, I'm the type of person who will get into some sort of dialogue and then walk away and I'll be like, I should have said this and I should have said that and I should have said that. But you can't go back, of course, because then you look like, you know, you're silly. But basically, I don't know, God spoke through me and I basically said, all right, let's think about this logically. Because that's the other thing he said. He said that because we are carrier of these genes and we pass on our genes to our offspring, he goes, they carry half of your genetics. They share half of your genetics. And so that's the reason you're likely to, put yourself in danger just to save your child. And I said, that's the silliest thing I've ever heard. Anyway, I said, all right, forget your child. Forget you have a child. Let's say you saw a child playing around the cliff, and then the very next second you saw that this child is dangling by the cliff. What would you do? I put this to him, and I said, what would you do? You don't share any of your genes. This is a random stranger, somebody else's child. What would you do? Would you leave them or would you go and save them? And this is God working, basically, because his response basically showed me that, thank God I said the right thing. Because he said, oh, okay, well, when you think about it that way. And he walked off. So you see, that doesn't make sense. But that's... In fact, let's take that a step further. I didn't discuss this with him, but I was just thinking about it now. Let's say that I was that person watching a child dangling by the cliff. If I was to run and save the child, because, of course, I'm a hero, what would the response be in the media, and so forth?
I thought that Spider-Man that climbed the
Oh, yeah, exactly. Okay, maybe that's where I got the idea. Yes. What was he regarded as? As a Spider-Man. Okay, that's not what I was looking for. You're not regarded as a Spider-Man. A hero. An absolute hero. Whereas, what if I saw the kid dangling and I said, you know what? We don't share the same genetics. We don't even look alike. I'm going to walk away and just... If he dies, it's his fault. He shouldn't have been playing there. What would be the response if someone was watching? A what?
A villain.
A coward. Selfish, and whatever it may be. All these things, so if, you're regarded as a hero if you were to act and to risk your life and to do those things. Again, what's that pointing us to? It's pointing us to something else. This objective morality. The fact that you risked your life for somebody else shows that something inside you, there's going to be two things going on inside me. One side of me is going to say, hey man, that cliff is a tall cliff. You could really die. Are you sure you want to do this? And then the other side's going to be saying, but it's the right thing to do. All right? I don't know what I'll do in that situation. I'm just saying. Okay? Any questions before we move on? Did I confuse anybody? Yeah, sorry.
Just sometimes in this day and age, you get a bit torn between your morality and your safety. Because sometimes you look at someone in the street and you go, I really want to help them, but then you're like, is this someone just faking it? You see a car on the side of the road and someone's needs help and you think, should I stop or shouldn't I? And your morality is torn between that and the risk.
Could not agree with you more. Has anyone done the first aid course recently?
2 years ago.
2 years ago, yeah. Did they talk to you about any of the obligations? Safety first, but you know, so years back, it was an obligation that if you did the safety, the first aid course, and you saw someone in distress, by law, it's hard to enforce, but by law, you were supposed to stop and try and help that person. But what was happening was, because of our law these days, and because, you know, if something was to happen to that person, so say I tried to save a person, they didn't survive, and then it was found that I was being negligent or I was misinformed or whatever it may be, then I'm liable and I can get sued. And so what they were finding was not many people were acting. So even though I've got the first aid training and I'm capable of helping somebody, I'm scared that if I do the wrong thing, I'm going to get sued. And so people were actually not acting, not helping each other out. And so they changed the law a couple of years ago, basically to say, regardless of what you do, if you were to help that person, even if you did something negligent, if you had the right cause and the right sort of mentality and the right approach, then you can't be held liable if something was to go wrong. So you're right. I agree with you. It's the way our society is sort of heading. Any questions before we move on? Okay. Objection 4. There's only one more after this, I promise. If morality is objective, then why do some cultures practice things such as female genital mutilation, cannibalism, infanticide, and other atrocities which we in the West deem unacceptable? Does that mean that basically the crux of this question is implying that morality is not objective and morality actually changes and is relative from society to society, from, you know, from culture to culture and so forth? That's the basis of this question. Does anybody have anything to say before I tell you what I sort of had in mind? What would you just say to somebody who said that to you?
I was just thinking these are very tough objections to overcome. So in one culture, they do the same thing as another culture. And in one culture, their conscience is completely, you know, on fire with that. And in our culture, this is a horrid thing to do. And the objective moral argument goes out the window.
Does that
answer
the question of what is the... That begs the question of what is the objective morality in the West based on, and in the larger God, the objective morality in the West is based on Christianity, whereas the cultures which are practicing these sort of ideals of what is correct for them tend to be basing their moral code on a different belief system, and we believe that morality stems from God, and that is why in the West we deem these things as concerns. Because where our moral code has come from is from a higher being who is innately good.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. That's a very good point.
But still, there's not a position here. I agree with it.
Yeah, it is.
We have our basis on Christianity in the West. We see one thing as bad. The same thing without the... So humans don't have a basic moral object, and that's what you're trying to prove, that without culture and without Christianity in the West, we should have the same moral compass to some degree. And what we're both saying is that, no, we've got our, because of Christianity in the West, and the barbarians or the cannibals in Africa, who are happy to do that, obviously haven't had Christianity as their base. So there is no objective moral argument, which has been influenced by Christianity.
Okay.
I just point out that female genital mutilation is a widespread practice in Egypt. So it's not just an African barbaric.
No. I was talking about cannibalism. I was avoiding that one.
Right. Okay, that's an interesting point. So basically, you're saying objective morality doesn't exist now. Yeah? So we went through the last three objections, and you come to this objection, and you turned your back on me. Thanks a lot. Okay. All right. Do you know, this is from C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. He talks about in the 1700s, there was a practice that was widespread, which is the burning of witches. We've all heard about it, obviously, in Europe. It was a big thing. It doesn't happen anymore, as far as I know. It doesn't happen anymore. Does that mean that morality has changed from the 1700s to today? That's what C.S. Lewis is asking, and he goes to answer that question, okay? And what he says is, he actually says, no, it hasn't changed. What's changed? What's changed between the 1700s? Sorry?
The understanding.
The understanding, exactly. So in the 1700s, they firmly believed that a witch, someone who's considered a witch, can put a curse on you and can make you die because of that curse. As time went on, they started to understand that no, you know, because a lady looks weird and dresses weird and whatever, has cats, that doesn't mean that she's a witch, and it doesn't mean that she can curse you to death. Okay? So we no longer burn witches. And so this is his idea. He's saying, in a nutshell, he's saying don't look at the action itself. So don't look at the action, but actually look at the morality behind the action. Because if you look beneath all these things, you tend to see that we still intrinsically have the same objective morality. We may practice it in weird and wonderful ways depending on our faith. I'll give you another example. We eat meat freely here, okay? Except now because we're fasting, so I'm sorry to bring up meat. But we eat cows, for example. In India, a lot of the population does not eat cows. Why is that? Is it because we have a very different morality? Our morality is different? Why do they not eat cows? The belief is different. What do they believe about the cows? Exactly, they hold the cows very sacred. Why? But they drink milk. Okay, I didn't know that. That's good. That's very good to know. Why are the cows so sacred? Do they think? Okay, yes. Well, yeah, so they believe in this thing called reincarnation, which I know all of you know what reincarnation is. And in a nutshell, they believe that some of their ancestors could very well be that cow that's standing before them. And that's the very reason that they don't.
Why not other animals?
I think it's cows, but I also think a lot of them hold to vegetarianism because of that reason, not just cows, because they believe that depending on what sort of life you've lived, you can go
either way.
Either way. So they don't eat cows or they don't eat other animals because they think that some of their ancestors might be in that very animal. So you and I would never like to eat geddu, or Teta, okay, and they believe the exact same thing, and the only difference is that we have a different faith. I don't believe my ancestors are residing in animals, whereas they do. Can you see now what I'm talking about? Let's look behind the actual action and the faith. Yeah? You know what? Let's move on to the last one, because I've taken too much of your time. There's a lot more to be said, but we can be here for another hour, so I don't want to waste your time. Objection number 5, and this is the last objection, and I promise we'll end it there. The objection is actually against the Bible now. But God, this is the objection, but God carried out many atrocities in the Old Testament. As an example, he ordered the genocide of the Canaanites. The genocide of the Canaanites. What do you guys think? So here, the person who's got a secular worldview, or the atheist basically, he's looking at the Bible and saying, this is what your Bible holds to be the truth. These are the atrocities you find in your Bible. And in fact, a lot of the new atheists who we've spoken about over the last couple of weeks are basically saying that the Bible is actually evil for these things and should be banned from being read in schools and from public services and things like that, for that very reason. And they're getting their way, actually. In a lot of places now, the Bible is not to be read. Why would God do such a thing? Is God immoral? Is God a tyrant? Is God evil? Why would God do such a thing?
Well, the easy answer is that you have to look at the context of the thing.
Yes, good.
But that's also a bit of a cop-out answer. Because
it's good.
Look at the context.
Yes.
Genocide is genocide. Like, what can ever justify genocide?
Good question. What does justify genocide? By the way, just because that's the objection, that doesn't mean that's what happened. It wasn't genocide. But anyway, so let's leave that for a minute. What justifies?
Isn't there something
Okay. Let me just say this before we continue. Sorry, it wasn't genocide. That's just the objection. It wasn't genocide because they weren't acting. God didn't tell them to go and persecute this particular people. God actually told them to drive them out of the land. What exactly? Okay, good. But what the actual statement was exactly to drive them out of the land, but for the purpose of the land, not for the purpose of killing them. But they were instructed to go and kill them. They were instructed to go and kill them. I'm not trying to...
No, when God told Saul to go kill the Amalekites, he told him to kill everything, livestock and all. When he killed some of the livestock and the king, God rejected him. So there was cases where God told... The one case I know, God told Saul to kill everything.
Yes.
But the answer I got for that is from John Lennox. But you probably...
No. Tell me. That's please.
Lennox said that... I'm not going to be able to put it properly, but in essence, God is sovereign, and it's probably a cop out, but we will see that this is justice being served. It would be unjust of God, if He did exist, to let this evil continue. At the end, it's because He's a just God that. No one will be able to stand at the end of time and tell him, you should not have kept these people alive. What you did was just. That getting rid of them is cleansing that you must have taken as a God.
Well, I'm actually going to say that answer is probably better than any response that I could have given you right now. But I want to know why you think that's a cop-out. You've given a great answer there.
The existence of God.
Yes.
So there you go. We're talking to an atheist.
Yes.
And we want to prove the existence of God. And to prove the moral argument, we say that God exists. So it's like a paradox. We've turned it into a paradox.
But if anything, you just affirm for them the fact that God is heartless and murderous.
No. Just. The argument is that God sees. Him being God, sovereign, good, and just, he sees that a cleansing was necessary, the evil that's happening. If he didn't do that, we would stand and tell him, you're unjust, you must have, you should have, or this needs to be cleansed, this evil must be gotten rid of by you, because you're God.
But you can say that about
use the mic, please. Yeah.
I'm a Canaanite. You need to explain to them what these people were doing. They were
okay.
Their own children. They were passing them as sacrifices
and
fire.
You.
So you need
good.
To explain what they were doing. And this was their judgments. And this is very true. If God would have let them live, this is complete injustice.
Yeah.
Completely unfair.
Yeah.
So that is why, if it was through the children of Israel or through any other catastrophe, those people's judgment would have been passed. So.
You just say basically, because you do need to put what the Canaanites did and how they lived in context of this argument.
Yeah, so further question back to them. So would they agree with the values of those people? Is that their values?
And God said, he waited till the Canaanites' cup was full before he passed judgment on him. He bore with them in patience until the cup was full of their...
I can just sit down.
And then he passed judgment on him.
Fantastic. Thank you. You basically said that was the response, right? So you mentioned that who are the Canaanites? What do we know about the Canaanites? You said child sacrifice. That picture there is one of their gods. They hold to many gods. His name is Moloch. He's holding a baby because that's what the Canaanites used to do. They used to sacrifice their children, infants and so forth, to appease to this god. What else do we know about the Canaanites? They were ruthless people. They used to practice bestiality and sexual orgies and you name it. Anything and everything they used to practice. What else do we know about the Canaanites? Did God act swiftly? Did he get in there and say, I will blot them out of the land? Or were they given a bit of warning? Sharif mentioned it.
Yeah.
How much warning? You know?
This is good for us here, the Coptic Orthodox Church. How do you take
that? No. I think there's merit in what you said. Believe me.
You believe it. You know, at the end of the day, I mean, take it or leave it. That's how it is.
That's not what he is about, though.
Because you're not going to convince him about God. You're going to explain to him the premise behind it. But explaining does God exist or not, this is a completely different argument.
Mm-hmm.
You're just explaining what this means.
Yeah, I can see that as well.
I just wanted to ask you a question. How did God act swiftly, or did he give him a bit of notice? Did he give him a chance to repent? Sorry?
It was almost 400 years because they were explaining this to Abraham before they entered Egypt.
Perfect. Okay. So in this case, they had 400 years with Sodom and Gomorrah. They were given plenty of opportunity with Nineveh.
If we're not gonna bring God into it, then what they're gonna say? Oh, then why don't we agree with like corporal punishment or like? So
yes.
If
okay.
We know God murdered or whatever, not murdered
yes.
these people because they were ruthless and murdering themselves. Why can't we do the same?
Yeah. Look, it's a very good question. The easy answer is the last objections, the last four objections basically, were trying to determine this moral, this objective morality. Now you'll notice that this question is actually very directed. It's basically saying, you want to talk about morality? Do you call this morality? And so now we have to change. We have to, rather than introduce what objective morality is, we have to actually try and explain why, as far as we know, because we can't understand the mind of God. And sometimes it's easy to just say, I don't know, because I will never understand God. But as best we know, why did God act the way he did? Okay? It's a very good question. It's a very good question.
Sorry. I can't ask why regarding to this... Canaanites, but we can also take it away to other places. What God has given a punishment, for example, Sodom and Gomorrah. We can see it very clearly. What were the warnings and how patient he was in this one.
Yes.
And even to the last minute, to the last second, still was waiting. He was waiting for them at least. We may not find the whole reasons him being waiting for canonizing, even putting them to, let's say, genocide board, but some has written and some hasn't written in the story. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it cannot be defined from that little short story, and the judgment is just like that.
Okay. Very well.
So we're looking at comparing to the other punishments he has given as well. We can find out how he's loving and just God he is. I think that was
That's a very good answer.
Balance it out with other acts of mercy.
Yes.
From the Old Testament as well.
Yeah. The one that comes to my mind is Nineveh. Why was Jonah so reluctant? Why was he so reluctant? He said this. Yeah, because he said, because I know God, and I know God will change his mind, and I know God will have mercy. And what did God do? He had mercy. Okay, yeah, that's a very good point. We can't just look at the action. We have to understand what's going on around that action. One thing that Sharif said, which struck me, which I think is a very good point, is that A lot of people always say, oh, look at the evil in this world. The evil in this world proves that God does not exist. How could God just stand there and watch this evil take place? Here we have a very clear example when there was evil in the world and God acted. And God acted and blotted out that evil. And then what are people saying? People who don't believe in God are saying, see, this is the type of God you want us to believe in. So if God acts, they're not happy. If God doesn't act, they're not happy. So where does the problem lie? Does the problem lie with God now? Or does the problem lie with the person who is reluctant to accept God? Yeah? Okay. Good. No, it's a good discussion. I like this. What about, can God commit murder? I won't take too much longer of your time. Can God commit murder? If I was the king and I said, go out and do this to the Canaanites, am I committing murder?
He's given life, he can take
it. Okay, good.
He's
good.
Not bound by morality that he needs.
Good point. I think.
He's not bound by what we're bound by.
He gave life and he's taking.
Sorry, can you use the microphone? Just because I'll get in trouble otherwise.
Atheists don't see it that way, that God gave life and so he can take
Yes, yeah. That's a very good point. This is more for us. I just want for us to understand, because someone said, this is my reasoning, but it's a cop-out. I don't want us to think that way. I want us to think, this is our reasoning and this is why. Yeah, you're right, Amal. You wouldn't go and say that to someone who doesn't believe in God. You'd start with why God exists in the first place. You wouldn't start with that story. I totally agree. Yeah. Okay. So God gives life. He has the power to take it away. If I was to take life, it's not mine to take. If I was to take my own life, it's not mine to take. As a Christian, we firmly believe that God gives us life and God is the one who takes it away. The very words of Job, right? When God allowed everything to be taken from Job, these were his words. I know we're running out of time. When I heard about this, the first thing I could think about was abortion. Do you know, when we're talking about morality, there's a massive argument going on in the US, and it's been going on for years, and it goes on here as well. Abortion, right? There's pro-choice and there's pro-life, right? What do the people who are supporting abortion say? They say it's my body, it's my choice. It's my moral decision, okay? But we who are opposed to that, we say, no, it's not your body. It's actually the body of a child within you, and it's not yours to take away, right? But when that person that says, it's my body and it's my choice, takes away that life, it's called a moral choice. But if God was to do the same thing, he's called an evil God. Can you see the irony? God was plotting out evil in this particular case, and people are pointing their finger and saying, is this the God you want us to believe? And that very person is walking outside the door and saying, yep, I'm going to kill the infant inside me because it's my moral decision to make, and they're being supported for doing so. I just want you to see.
Quite genocide with the abortion of one
child.
I would say it's worse. But we can... Sorry, for the sake of time... No, please make your point.
No, that was my point. You can equate genocide with the abortion of one child.
I don't think it should matter how many lives it is because you think the life is a life.
Yeah.
Did you want to say something?
No, that was it.
Say it. This is the first comment you've made. I'm so happy. I'm not going to take too much longer. It's a very good point. We'll talk about that over the snacks. I would actually look at this to be a greater good, and look at the other case, abortion, to be the atrocity, the real atrocity. Why? This is eradicating evil with the baby. When you're ending a life, what are you doing? You're getting rid of something that's good, potentially good, right?
But you're ending a life
by the way. Yeah. But the difference is, one is the one that gave life and he takes it away. The other person is myself, who has no right to take life, has no right to give life.
I think she's balancing human genocide versus God genocide.
Yeah, okay. Okay. And again, sorry, I'm just going to, just for the sake of time, but let's have this conversation outside. Something else that Sharif said, which was very interesting, was that this is justice. This is actually God exercising his justice. We believe in God who's not just merciful, but a God who is just. Okay? I'm going to conclude. There is nothing else for me to say. We'll talk about... It's good. I'm happy you guys are talking. I just want to conclude, okay? Moral values, according to what we saw, hopefully, seem to be properties of people, of persons, okay? We can't say that these moral values exist in animals because, quite frankly, we have not seen them and we haven't seen any proof of such. If we were to see proof of such, we still would not say that that's because of evolution, okay? Because the God who created me is also the God who created the animals. That's one thing. This very law that's prescribed in me is the law of God, okay? We can try and prescribe it to somebody else. We can try and say that it's a process of evolution and so forth. But the fact of the matter is that this law points to a prescriber, and that prescriber is our God. So last week we looked at God as being the creator of the universe and God the creator of earth and, you know, creating this perfect environment for us to live. Now we get to see God's character. And Miriam said something interesting. What was the last comment you said? Say it again. It was actually a good comment. I actually like that comment. Very, very interesting point. God is not bound by the same morality that we are bound. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I really don't. But what I would... No. I'm not saying you're wrong. My personal view, and I don't know. I genuinely... If you have something to share, please share it. I would look at God as the prescriber of this moral law, and I would think that who I am, this objective moral law that's within me, is actually inscribed by the person who is that goodness, who is that law. So when we talk about objective morality, we say, yep, it's something that's above, it's something that's bigger than who I am, it's something that's objective, it's not personal for me. But by looking at this objective law, I see who God is. So I would tend to think that they're very linked. In fact, it points us to who God is. But that's just my two cents worth. Okay? I wanted to conclude with one verse. Everything that is good in us is from God. And this is what we're told in Mark chapter 10, verse 18. We're told, but because no one is good but God alone. Okay? So when we look at this thing inside us that's telling us to go and do something right, to go and do something good, to give of our time, to give of our efforts and so forth, if I don't believe in God and God is foreign to me, that very fabric that's good in me points to God who is good. Okay? That's the moral argument in one phrase, in one sentence. I'm done. I promise. I'm sorry for taking so long. Glory be to God forever and ever. Amen.